This is Rose Norman. It's December 21st, 2012, and I'm talking with Donna Burnell. I always want to call you Burrell. Burnell, at my home in Huntsville, Alabama. And we're interviewing for the Southern Feminist, Lesbian Feminist Herstory Project. And Donna is going to talk about her time in Gainesville, where she was went to high school and college, got into CR, now ERA activism. Those are the main things we're going to talk about on this interview. Okay, Donna.
Well, I started at the University of Florida, and I was just sort of your typical student those days, a hippie, and protesting the Vietnam War, and there just came a time in my life where just everybody that I was close to was male. And I'd heard about women's liberation, and I think I'd taken a class at the University of Florida with a professor named Carolyn Griffiths, and we studied protest movements. And so I was reading a little bit about feminism, and I thought, you know, I really should look into that because I don't have any women friends. And I kind of wish that I was male. So, you know, we didn't have the surgeries in those days. And so I thought, well, I better sort of rearrange this. And so I sought out, and it was, I believe, an ad in the University of Florida newspaper, The Alligator, advertising the CR groups. And so I went to the meeting to form CR groups. And my memory is that you just sort of chose one based on a time you could show up, but you really had to come every time. You couldn't, you know, be sort of a sometime attendee. You really had to make a commitment to show up. And so I went, and they capped the group at a certain, at 10 or something, I don't know, some sort of number like that. I didn't have any sense of the history of Gainesville Women's Liberation groups until, you know, this today. I don't remember, you know, it was not a strong leadership. It was very consensus. How does everybody feel about that when the steering committee or whatever they called it, you know, met? But anyway, I started going to the groups, and I just thrived in consciousness raising because I found out I was not such a weird person, which growing up in the 50s, I felt like an alien. And I don't mean from another country, I mean another planet, another solar system. And so to find anybody who felt the same way I did on a number of things was just astounding to me, because I just really thought, nobody feels this way, and so just shut up and, you know, do your own thing and go your own way, but don't talk about it. And I had one of the things that anybody during that decade, or gosh, any subsequent decade, unfortunately, in Gainesville, is either being raped or a rape experience. And everybody in our group, Gainesville was number one in the FBI Uniform Crime Report so many times, and in the 80s it was actually number one of the top 10 for rape. And I just read a very disturbing article last month where that seems to be continuing to be the case. And so that's one of the issues that comes up in CR, and all of the women there had either some really close experience with rape or had been raped. And again, this was something I'd had a really close experience, but I fought back. I had no idea why I did. I just did. You know, I'd had no training. Nobody had ever talked to me about it. I just did. And to find out that everybody else was in the same boat, again, it was this eye-opening thing of, oh my gosh, you're not such a weird, bad person that this, you know, almost happened to you. This is women's experience. And so, I mean, I really got the whole what you were supposed to get from CR, I got it. And so I was very close with that group. Eventually, we got an overture and came together as a steering committee to consider and hear from this woman named Edna Safi, who was a graduate student, as I recall at the time, at the University of Florida. And she wanted to start a national organization for women group on campus, and she wanted to let people know that they could come and be in the NOW group and also see whatever, you know, places they could work together. She made her presentation and left, and I remember my remembrance of it is that I was, I think most of the women there were fine with what she had to say and liked her personally, but they didn't like the idea of how structured NOW was. It was an organization, and so it was run in a male-like way, and they kind of objected to that because we were so unstructured within Gay's Women's Liberation. I liked more hard-hitting political protests, like I was seeing with the anti-Vietnam War protests, and this actually was another sort of thread into going to see our groups was how male chauvinist and downright piggy the men were in the Vietnam protests and their total disregard and lack of respect for women. And so I had experienced that side of it, and so I knew I didn't want to put any activist energy there, but I knew that something more had to happen besides consciousness raising. I couldn't go around with all this consciousness raised and not do anything. So I really liked the idea, and that's what Edna spoke to, is actually, you know, don't get mad, you know, get even. Don't agonize, organize. And that really spoke to me. And so I wanted to join the NOW group, but sort of maintain my connection with Gay's Women's Liberation. At some point, that became a problem, I guess, not acceptable. And I kind of think that I was forced to choose.
So the CR groups were equivalent to Gay's Women's Liberation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the CR groups, that was a, there was no real thrust. I mean, like I said, there was, my memory is there was a steering committee, and I think why I remember it so strongly, it was the first time I'd ever seen sort of in a public, because, you know, we all met as the steering committee in the student union. And there was one woman sitting in another woman's lap, and they were all entwined. And it was the first time I'd ever seen that outside of, you know, like a home, you know, very private area. It was like, oh, my gosh, people will see you. And so I was really fascinated by, you know, their comfortableness in expressing, you know, that sort of romantic energy in public. You know, it was the first time I'd seen it. So I think that's why I remember that. But at any rate, like I said, my memory is very vague, but I feel that I was forced to sort of choose, and the CR groups were kind of winding down, and again, you know, I felt very liberated. I felt like I really needed to take this energy and do something with it, and so I would have to say that I came down on the NOW side. I was like, well, if you're going to be that way, you know, Edna's not making me choose. You all are making me choose, and so I'm going to go with the NOW group. And now most of the energy in this NOW group, they were older. There was Jeanette Blevins, who was staff at the university. Edna Safi was a graduate student. When we would go to the state of Florida beginning meetings for a state national organization for women, everybody was older than me. And what I found when we had about a 10-year reunion later on into the 80s is that I'm constantly running to catch up. And they've all let go of it, and I'm still trying to surpass them, and I've surpassed them, but I don't realize it because I'm always running to catch up. And I had that experience so often with this protest stuff. Most of the people I hung out with at the Vietnam War protests are older than me. And so I'm constantly trying to be, you know, get it together because I'm the younger one, and, you know, live up to this ideal that I have in my head. And like I said, it's only years and decades later I realize, my God, I've actually done more than they have done, and I'm still in my mind trying to catch up to them. So that's kind of just a funny aside. But anyway, okay, so where are we in the story? So I leave the conscious grazing groups. I join in with NOW. I'm really kind of on the periphery. I'm graduating from college. I'm getting my first jobs. This sort of thing is going on, and I remember being like maybe the first treasurer of the student university chapter of NOW, and then I participate in the Florida parades for the RA, which was mostly put on by the Gainesville chapter, and Edna Safi is the parade leader. And it was one of the first and biggest women's marches that we had in Tallahassee. Let's see. I go through some turmoil in my work life. I get this fantastic job out at Sunland Training Center, which is the state school for the mentally retarded. And I'm actually using my psychology BA, which is like unheard of. And so I become very involved in that for the longest time. But there's a certain, the grant ends, and also who I'm working with there are Carol Martin, who's involved in the Women's Center. But I've already told you earlier that she's kind of on the outs with a lot of the, you know, main wheels of the, you know, Women's Center. But now she writes lesbian mysteries. Oh. I'm trying to remember her writer's name is A.J. Martin, I think.
Huh.
But anyway, and also Sally Ann Harrison works out at Sunland at that time.
Okay.
And I know both of them, and I hang out with them. We have a lot of informal networking in Gainesville, and so I maintain that all through this time, but I'm not really doing a lot of activism. I sort of come back into the activism once I quit that job. And I'm kind of homeless. I'm out at the Red House with Corky Culver for maybe a month. I'm living with Marcia West. We end up in a pup tent on Lorelei Esser's property where we eat blueberries all summer and get food stamps. And so this has to be the summer of 79. What I do then is say, well, I've got this nice psychology degree, which is actually in experimental behavior of analysis. So I'm in on operant conditioning and Skinner and behavior modification and hard science. And I've actually been working in that area for, I don't know, let's see, it's about 75 to 78, so about 3 years maybe.
This is Sunland.
Yeah, I'm working in that area. But I look around and I go, gee, I think I'll put in a resume, a job application at the women's clinic. And so I turned the psychology degree into counseling. I actually just let them think it's counseling. And they do. But where I do have counseling experience is one of the things that Judy Margaret and Billy, Judy Levy, Billy Avery, and Margaret Parrish are in on starting in, say, 1974, so at the end of my college years, is a rape crisis line.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the experience I had with rape, I knew I never wanted to be raped. Mm-hmm. And I knew it would be pretty awful. And so another connection is Alice McAdam. Mm-hmm. Alice works at the Alligator with me. That's how I meet up with Alice. Mm-hmm. And she and I are feminists. And one of the things we do at the newspaper is we take our little exactos, and when somebody writes, well, she does the job as well as any man, we sort of rearrange the writing. And nobody ever catches on to that. But so Alice and I are friends. I'm hanging out with, you know, Alice sort of socially, and she has gone up to the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. She moved to D.C. for a while, and then she comes back to Gainesville, and that's all she can talk about. And she knows self-defense, and she's feisty, and I like Alice. And she is also, she's the parade marshal, I think. No. She organizes the security or something for the ERA parade. So she's a big deal in that. And so Alice is able to feed in a lot of energy to this rape crisis line. It's done through the women's clinic. So the women's clinic is in existence at that time, and the only connection I have is I've gone for training with Judy Levy, who has a PhD in psychology, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And so I can draw on that counseling experience that I've gotten from that rape crisis line. Now, I don't know if anybody has talked to you about that rape crisis line, but one of the interesting things is because of the especially for that time, the radicalism of Alice McAdam, we will just take calls and the women remain anonymous unless they want to tell us their name. And Alice then catches on to, from the calls that we're getting, that there's a number of rapes in Gainesville that are obviously the same perpetrator. And so she takes this information. We know on such and such a date that a rape happened in this approximate area, and this is the MO. The guy always says this, or he comes through the window, or he holds a knife to her throat, or whatever it is. She takes that data to the police, and they threaten to arrest all of us for aiding and abetting, because we're not making these women report to the police. And so there's a point at which Alice and Judy and all come back to the group, to the, you know, the women who are answering this line, and say, if you continue with us, you may get arrested. Well, I don't have anything to lose. I don't own a home. I have a motorcycle. You know, I'm like, yeah, come get me. You know, whatever. And so we stand up to the police. We find out, Alice continues the conversation with them, and she finds out they're asking the women who do get it, bold enough to go into the police station and say, hey, I was raped. Did you come? Did you like it? What were you doing there? What were you wearing? These were their standard questions. And so Alice challenges the police and says, we would never in a million years send a woman who was raped to you all with what you do to them. And we end up doing, well, mostly Alice, doing training and sensitivity to the police to try to get them better. But one of the offshoots out of this rape crisis line is that because we advertise it in a lot of places, that there's this crisis line that you can call and talk to, we start getting women who are calling saying, I'm 70 and my father, raped me as a child. So these rapes were like 60 years ago. And we're like, whoa, what's with this whole thing? We don't realize until we do the rape crisis line how much incest is going on, how much these women are suffering for, decades. But also women are calling up going, I haven't been raped, but my husband beats me every Saturday night. And so the battered women's shelter is an offshoot of that rape crisis line. There's an early, in I think 75, child abuse and child sexual abuse conference in Gainesville because of the what we're being told on this line.
So is this something that Judy Levy organizes, or
the conference? I actually organized with, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember her name. She was another PhD psychologist. It wasn't that, things that went on in Gainesville. It was more, there was so much going on during that time period, and even now, that it wasn't like, oh, I don't want to participate. It was more like, you go off and do it and I'll help you every way I can and all that. So that's my memory of it, was that people were very supportive. I'll have to remember her name later. And she had this PhD psychologist. She had a good friend who worked at the university as well. And I want to say she was like a dean or something. And all I can remember is her nickname was Worm. So Margaret Parrish knows who I'm talking about.
Oh, that's great. It may be in her interview.
Yeah, she'll know who I'm talking about there. So I go to the clinic, I put in my resume, I let them, think that I'm just a dynamite counselor because now I have, a BA in psychology, and I'm able to use the skills that I've gotten from the rape crisis line because they were so good, to listen and to reflect back. I mean, all the things that you still hear today, they were doing as lay people. And so I'm hired at the clinic in that year.
So this is 79.
Okay. The first thing that happens with the clinic... Do you want me to go on with the clinic?
Yeah, keep going.
The first thing that happens with the clinic is there's three of us who were hired at the same time. And from very different, you know, we don't know each other until we start working. Well, I might have heard of Sharon before, but there's three of us who were hired as counselors at the same time, and we're working, and we're hired as abortion counselors. Now, I have very little medical experience. I always swore I'd have nothing to do with medicine. Having watched my roommates in 74 go through their first year of medical school, I swore I'd have even less to do with medicine. That it was just, you know, all corrupt and all terrible, and it was just awful what they did to train medical students. And that their cohort in medical school at Shands Teaching Hospital in Gainesville is the first time they allow women in. And so I become close friends through that group with Kathy Cantwell.
Is she the one who was in the bad wreck?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Kathy Cantwell, at that point, before she goes to medical school, she had been a nurse, and she's married to a man who I think is from Chile. And so she's, you know, going to South America, and she is like the Martha Stewart. You know, I mean, she's not like really well known or even in the feminist community at all, but she goes to medical school, and I think it kind of radicalizes her. But I hear about that treatment of what's going on. The surgeons that year, you know, like failed every female student, no matter how well they did. It didn't matter.
You're saying these are the first women to go through this Shand medical school. Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so watching medicine, oh, and I should say, too, that I had that same experience with the University of Florida. Mm-hmm. When I got done with my bachelor's in psychology, I had been working with Dr. Pennypacker, Dr. Malagodi, Dr. Adams, and a little bit with Dr. Goldstein, all men. And they loved my work. I worked in the, you know, experimental lab. I got A's in the courses, because I really responded. I thought I would like the counseling side of psychology, but they were like all into Jung, and I couldn't do it. It made no sense to me. And so when I found operant conditioning, I was like, okay, this sounds like something that can go somewhere. I understand it. It's not all about dreams. It's about reality. And so I went, and my advisor was Dr. Malagodi, and I would go and ask him about going to graduate school, and he would get up and leave the office. Should have gotten a hint from that. And I tried to get recommendations from those three, and to a man, they all told me, you're just going to get pregnant and married, or married and pregnant and drop out, and we don't want women in graduate school. So that's like the fall semester, or fall quarter, I guess we were then, of 74. And, when I tell people that today, they're all like, well, why don't you sue? And it just never even occurred to me.
Was it even illegal yet?
I don't know. I mean, but it didn't occur to me to sue. And so I just accepted it. It was just like, because I had wanted to get a PhD. I had always wanted to get a PhD. And when that door just slammed, I was like, well, that, you know, now what? And that's one of the things that really, other than this trying to catch up to the activists that I admired, that really fueled my feminism. Mm-hmm. Somebody once asked me, how are you going to recruit more feminists? And I said, the patriarchy just cranks them out. We don't have to go recruit them. They make them all the time. And she was actually shocked by that answer. I was like, how could you be shocked? Just look around. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to go and just advertise you're there, and the pissed off women just come streaming in. You know, and I was one of those ones who was just so, disappointed and angry. But again, through the earlier CR, you don't just sit and be angry and frustrated and depressed. You go out and you do something about it. So I was like, well, you know, I think this is wrong, and what I do about wrong is I go and I fix it. So that was another fueling factor there. Thank you, Dr. Malagodi. but that's why there's 22 years between my getting a BA and my going back to graduate school. It took me a long time to sort of feel like it was okay again. And they did let women in shortly thereafter, after that year, about maybe in 1976, they started letting women into that side of psychology. And I actually got to hang out with them all at conferences, because remember, I'm working in the discipline. And so we go to the Midwestern Association of Behavior Analysis, or Applied Behavior Analysis. We go to the big conference with Nate Azrin and all the heavyweights in that kind of, you know, psychology. And I'm able to see my old professors interacting with their female graduate students. The first thing I notice is that these female graduate students are beyond meek and mild. So I'm going, well, I don't think I would have, you know, I could never have kept that together. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is I would stand there and watch them. Oh, hi, you know, good buddy, come over here and meet my graduate students. And they would introduce the men and skip over the women. It was like she wasn't even there, and she'd be standing there smiling. And again, I was like, I couldn't hold it together. So even if I had fought my way in, you know, it just wasn't going to happen.
I think all of that's kind of a footnote, but that's certainly a consciousness raising.
Yeah, people are shocked that the University of Florida did that. But
yeah,
that's,
I know.
That's what was going on at that time.
Yeah. I think that was kind of a footnote from when you went to the clinic. There's three counselors had at the same time,
right,
doing rape counseling, and somehow that led up
abortion counseling.
Because rape counseling is how you got into feeling like you could do counseling.
So I had never really been around medicine. I was sure, you know, as I was doing the train, we had this great trainer named Yona Levin. She was from up north, maybe New York, and she's gone back up to New York. But she had some sort of formal training in psychology or counseling, and she was just a lesbian feminist. She was marvelous. But I was sure I was going to faint. I'm sure, you know, the blood, the surgery, the needles, something, I was going to faint. But I didn't, and I got through it, and so I became more comfortable with medicine from that point on. But one of the first things that happened to us at the clinic was, like, maybe about 2 or 3 months after we were hired, became a $10,000 deficit, because the bookkeeper had ripped off the clinic and gone off to Alaska. And we had to sit through this meeting, and most of the sort of higher-ups, the clinic wasn't real structured then. It was sort of a board of directors, what do they call it? Called it something, you know, the committee who ran it. I don't even think there was a CEO or definite, you know, leader. And they kind of treated us like we were the unwanted children, the three of us. They kind of looked at us like, well, maybe we could cure that $10,000 deficit if we got rid of the three new ones, you know. And they actually had a meeting where they had to decide whether to keep us on or not. So that really banded us together and gave us a good insight. But then the proposal became that they were going to have bake sales. And I was going, are you serious? You're going to bake sale your way out of a tent? That's going to be a lot of brownies. And I can't remember, you know, exactly what happened, but we were able to keep our jobs, but it was just always rocky at the clinic. Mm-hmm. Now, that's after the divorce. I'm curious whether Margaret mentioned the divorce.
Her divorce?
No, the clinic had a divorce. The clinic divorced the birthing center.
She did talk about that. Was the 80s though, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was before, it had to be in the 70s because it was before I came. And see, that my perspective on that is very interesting, because again, I'm able to bridge these groups where I don't have a solid you know, handle in one, or I'm not known to be on this side or that side. Cool. And what happens with me is I start working with Judy, Margaret, and Billy, who are still at the Gainesville Women's Health Center, in 78. And I start meeting with them over the Mother's Day March for ERA. And they always want to meet at the clinic because they're always working there. And so I go into the clinic and I can see the staff is looking at them. Not so much Billy. Billy didn't seem to be around a lot, but Margaret and Judy really caught it. The staff is looking at them with hatred in their eyes. And I'm going, what's up with this place? You know, this is no different than, you know, where I worked for the state, where everybody was at everybody's throat, you know, for no good reason. And so, and the staff is looking at me like, oh, you're with them. And I'm like, oh boy, there's something really big going on here. And what happens is there's some crackdown about signing, I don't know, hours or something. And, yeah, okay, they do a management takeover. The place probably was having money troubles, who knows? Mm-hmm. And so Judy and Margaret and Billy are on the hook as far as, you know, they're on the paper as a corporate, you know, people. And so they do kind of a more heavy-handed management thing, and the staff revolts, and they take, you know, because it's before computers, they take all the patient identification chart records, so you can't figure out how to find a patient in all those charts, and the appointment book. Because Judy, Margaret, and Billy locked the staff out or something. Now, I'm just all here in this, you know, yeah, in the community.
Yeah.
And so and then the lawyers get involved, and I think Brown and Miller are in on that, and they're on Judy, Margaret, and Billy's side, because they're the professionals. Right? And we're all grassroots. But I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm lumped in on the Judy, Margaret, and Billy side because I'm hanging out with them doing the Mother's Day March for ERA. And so, you know, I don't know how, like, a year later after this, you know, divorce, it sort of all comes to pass that I'm not on the hook. But somehow I'm not. They, you know, accept me. So...
The clinic birthing center divorce is while you're there.
No, it's while I'm in the community, but I don't have links to either one. I'm only linked with Judy, Margaret, and Billy over this March.
So what is it in relation to when you work there?
I go to work at the clinic about a year later.
Okay.
About a year later. And I think by then... Billy's getting ready to take off for Atlanta.
Okay.
And they're all over at the birthing center. Mm-hmm. I don't really, you know, see them anymore.
Oh, that's where they went. They went to the birthing. Okay. They bought the birthing center or something like that?
Well, I think the birthing center was created off of the Gaines Women's Health Center. And so that's the settlement of the divorce, is you guys get the birthing center and the staff will own the Gaines Women's Health Center.
Which was the abortion clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I got that. So when you went to work there, you were not with the Judy, Margaret, and Billy, you were with the clinic because you were doing abortion counseling and they were doing the other stuff.
Yeah.
Even though it originally was the whole thing. Mark talked mostly about how what they were doing,
yeah,
that whole spectrum, full spectrum, was something nobody else in the country was doing.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. We had Carol Downer come. Yeah. I mean, they did. Mm-hmm. And... shortly after, I think she got arrested, you know, for the yogurt or something. Yeah, they were doing a whole lot of really cutting edge medicine with the Gaines Women's Health and with the birthing center too. So it was really sad for me sitting out in the community to you know get in there and know that this big split had happened. But you know, splits had happened before. Mm-hmm. I just, again, I don't remember during my interview, and now that I'm looking at how close these events were, why they weren't saying, hey, you were just hanging out with these, you know, birthing center people. I don't know why that didn't come up, except, again, that what some of the main energy at the clinic at that time was people from the farm, mm-hmm. so Linda Lou and Marilyn, and they knew Marcia, and really I was more with Marcia than with Judy, Margaret, and Billy. And once we were done with the march, we sort of went our separate ways.
What was the farm connection to Gainesville?
Sorry?
Well, how did the farm get connected to Gainesville?
See, our farm is Linda Lou Simmons, Archer farm. Not that farm.
Okay.
I know about that farm, but
So you're now working as an abortion counselor, you and two other people, and you narrowly miss getting laid off when there is an embezzler. And how did you eventually get fired or whatever it was? Kicked? You said you got kicked out of the women's? No, that was something else.
I'm actually at the clinic for 11 years.
11 years, okay. As an abortion counselor.
Well, yes. And then I eventually was the counseling director, I think we called it. And I worked as a lab tech. I worked in the CSR, the central sterilizing. Not a lot, but... when there was no one else, I made a stab at it. And
so that's 79 to 90?
Yeah.
89?
Yeah, 90. Wow. Actually, I think I left February of 91.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And eventually I was director.
Wow, God. Of the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that thing doesn't close down until 97, right?
I think probably more like 94. I think it's earlier than 97. Patricia Lassiter and Abby Palmer were kind of in charge then. The deficit, I think. Sorry, Abby. This is different from Abby Goldsmith. There's a couple of Abbeys. You know, in on the health center. But Abby Palmer was a sweet person. Oh, very, very nice person. Not a really good business person. And I mean, you had to be tough. Mm-hmm. You had to be tough with that place. Oh, my goodness, the things. But there was always a deficit. There's always, I mean, $10,000, we ran with a $30,000 deficit. And we just didn't worry about it. But it drove Abby crazy. I mean, she didn't like it. She wanted to balance the budget. And in balancing the budget, it either became apparent they couldn't do that or it did the clinic in. I don't know which.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, if you were going to pay that close of attention to the money, then you were going to drive yourself crazy. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So I was there during when the protest, when I first went to the Gainesville Women's Health Center, it was on 4th Avenue, I think, in Southwest, across from Alachua General Hospital. So we were in the medical district, but that's where we first start having protesters.
Mm-hmm.
So when I actually first started at the clinic, we didn't have any protesters. Mm-hmm. That comes a little later. And the church we're dealing with is called Maranatha, and they have, you know, it's like right, this medical district was right up on the university campus. I mean, like down the street from the administration building. And Maranatha is a campus ministry, and they had their headquarters or building or office in that same area. And so it was very easy for them to organize on a Saturday and then come down to the clinic to protest.
So
for some reason, I was always the one in charge of security. Again, I think I'm following in Alice's steps. And so, you know, I get charged with very early on getting out there and going nose to nose with protesters.
So I should add that to the list of things that you were doing. Director of counseling, lab tech, in charge of security. And when would you say that the protesting began? You started in 79. There's no protesters. Is it in the 80s or?
It could be. It could be as. Oh, yeah. I'm thinking that when Ronald Reagan came in, that gave them a real lift. Yeah, it could definitely be, you know, in the early 80s.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I want to pause this. Where's the pause? Okay. Yeah. So talk about the 80s and your experience of the 80s compared to the 70s.
Well, the 70s, I'm just so young. I don't know why I'm so immature then, but I you know, looking back on it, I'm like, oh, my God, you know. I mean, I have to constantly remind myself now that I'm a professor and the students forget things and they promise they'll do something, and, you know, that I was that was me. You know? So quit being so hard on them because I did exactly everything that they're doing. But... And again, I'm doing this, I got to catch up to. You know, Alice is gone by then. She had moved to Tallahassee, I think, and was really into, she's sort of the first lobbyist for state now, as I recall, Alice McAdam. Edna Sappi has graduated and gone to Jacksonville. Jeanette Blevins, who was a secretary staff at the University of Florida, she has gone to law school. And gone up and lived in D.C. So my role models that I'm always trying to catch up to have all left town, but I'm still trying to catch up to them. So when I get to the Women's Health Center, of course, that takes all kinds of energy, but then this protester thing comes in with the abortion politics, and that's, you know, that to me is just wonderful. You know, a lot of the energy at the clinic at that time, during the late 70s when I start and the early 80s, is very, you know, we're going to be all about love and connecting and peaceful, and I can do that for a certain time period and then I get feistier. So the being outside with the protesters is a real good use of my energy, because this is people I can mess with. This is people I can, you know, yell at or call the police on or be aggressive with. And so I can really, you know, get that energy out there and do something that the rest of them don't want to mess with, mm-hmm. You know. And I'm protecting the clinic, so I'm doing it for a good reason. I ultimately become very close to the women in this clinic. There's about 30, 35. It's a pretty mm-hmm. big staff. A lot of them work, you know, part-time. And there's a woman up in the front office, and she is wild and crazy. She is pretty much just like me. She's just not going to take orders from anyone for any good reason. And she comes to work in these, you know, really high heels with the little fuzzy, you know, feet on them, you know, pink feathery things. And she just wears anything she wants to, which is, you know, almost unfeminist in those days. But she's just going to be her, and her name is Gethin. And she's in a fire, and she's killed. And not even, it takes 18 days, but I mean, she's in this terrible fire. And so she's like gone overnight. And Abby Goldsmith, now Abby is a very interesting person. In the 70s, Abby isn't really at the university. She's not a student, but she's in the community, and she's an anarchist. And I meet up with Abby during my travels, and I kind of admire, you know, who she is. I mean, she has people like living under her dining room table. I mean, she's just totally wild and crazy. And she's very forceful, very down-to-earth kind of personality. I really like that about her. And she's working at the clinic, and she's very close to Gethin. And so she and I go out and proceed to have too many pitchers of beer at the Windjammer and decide we've got to get politically involved. That we're going to take this energy of feeling like our life could end at any moment and all that. We've got to get politically involved. And what's going on in, gosh, this would have been, I think, 82, is that the ERA is coming due again. It got that extension, which is why they didn't want us doing anything in 78. Got an extension, but the extension is only for 4 years, and so it's coming all due again. And the ERA missionaries have come to town. They have been sent by Ellie Smeal and the ERA groups that have gotten together as a coalition. You know, of course, National Now is, you know, in the thick of it. There's no Now chapter functioning. The student chapter has gone totally into peace and love, and I don't know what they're doing, but anytime I inquire about them, I'm told that the leader of the student group, who I actually think I knew her name and had met her, but she was more interested in navel gazing or some, you know, derogatory thing like that. And so the ERA missionaries are kind of, and we didn't know they were called missionaries until much later. The ERA action team are these folks from, feminists from up north somewhere, who have come down to the South, particularly Florida, to get the ERA moving. And they're floundering around. They're lost. They don't know anybody in the feminist community other than people who've just come to town. Most of the organized feminists would not deal with them. Hmm. And Abby and I decide we're going to bite the bullet. We're going to go work on the ERA. And so we go over and we start volunteering our services. Now, I don't know how much Abby did, because I don't think, I mean, these people, oh my Lord. They'd get on the phone in front of us and talk about, you wouldn't believe how large the insects are here and the natives don't seem to notice. It was like, this is really not helping the Bondi project. You know, and they just, I don't know, they just, there were so many stories like that. So they weren't the easiest folks to get along with. But I was, again, seen as different because I was a northerner. So I wasn't one of them that didn't get it, that we have to come help. Right. I wasn't seen as a native. And I'm like, I don't know how I always get in this one foot in both camp, but there I was again. And
because you don't have that heavy accent or something?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. So the ERA ends on something like June 6, 1982. And these, one thing I will say about the ERA action team and the missionaries, they worked nonstop. They might have been not as obnoxious as hell, but they worked nonstop. I mean, 50, 60-hour weeks, six of them. They organized Gainesville from top to bottom. They knew who was who, how they were connected to somebody else. And slowly I was able to get the community in. As long as I kept them far away from the obnoxious northern people, I could, you know, get the, you know, like Corky and that whole group to, you know, come to things or do something. And, you know, but when their big project was, we're going to, they came in one day and they must have had orders from Washington. We're going to turn Senator Kirkpatrick around. Well, Senator Kirkpatrick was a good old boy who had run on an anti-ERA platform. His wife was more anti-ERA than he was. And we were sitting there going, now, we're going to go convince him with green balloons and a plant? I don't think so. You know? Unless you know, we'd be further along in this project if we could figure out who he frequented for sex and blackmail him. I mean, now we're talking. You know, but balloons and a plant aren't going to do it, you know, because he's got way too much political support to be anti-ERA. So we, you know, we were like, you know, these people have something going, but they don't have the whole thing. They were going to, at the end of the ERA campaign, take all the resources, all the boxes, you know, because, again, we didn't have computers yet, all the boxes of cards that people had signed out, signing the ERA petition where they indicated what they were willing to do, what their address was, you know, all this information. They were going to take that all with them unless we started a Now chapter. Then they could leave it with us. So Abby Goldsmith and I started the second Town Now chapter 1982, and we called it Gainesville Area Now, which was a negotiated, who knew that a name, I mean, Abby's even more cut and dried than I am. Abby's like, just slap a name on there, let's get this done. and so we were going to call it, I think, Alachua County Now. Mm-hmm. And Felicity Trueblood, who was a professor at University of Florida, and she and Phyllis Meek, who is a dean, were very much in on the ERA campaign. And Felicity objected because she lived in Putnam County. She said, if you call it, you know, Alachua County, it won't include me. I'm like, oh, you're being so picky. Who cares? We just want the resource. We don't care what we call it, you know. And so I think that's how we got to Gainesville Area. But that's the reason we started the chapter, was a negotiated, you must start this chapter or we'll take everything with us. Mm-hmm. And so they did leave everything. We supported a pro-ERA candidate named Margaret Epps, who was out of the League of Women Voters for Senate. She came really close to defeating George Kirkpatrick, which was astounding in those days that we could get that much. Because it would be like running a Democrat anywhere in Alabama right now. It just seems so helpless. Running against Shelby, mm-hmm. and coming really close. Mm-hmm. The thing with Margaret that was very interesting is Abby and I go up to her campaign headquarters, and we have volunteers that we have all gathered there. They're streaming out the doors, crying, gnashing their teeth, angry like I've never seen. All these young women. I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? Your candidate's anti-abortion! Oh dear. And so we have to sit Margaret down in the windjammer for like 3 hours and go through it. You can personally be against it, but, you know, politically, you know, if you're elected, mm-hmm. you have to support Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And this is why. And just go through all the stories with her.
Wow. I think we need to stop.